The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme, the Fenian invasion of Canada.
There's all of this hostility between the US and Britain, and there's an opportunity in the minds of the Fenian Brotherhood to maybe spark an Anglo-American war. So Canada is the most obvious place.
Why Irish Republicans decided to raid America's neighbour to the north to strike a blow against the British Empire. And coming up a little later, Padraig Yates joins me to talk about the truth recovery process, a proposal to address the legacy of the Troubles. But we begin this evening with the papal conclave. The death of a pontiff triggers a huge transition for the Catholic Church. A successor must be chosen to follow Pope Francis, who passed away just 6 days ago. All eyes will be on Rome, where a week or two from now, cardinals will gather at the Vatican to begin the process of selecting the next pope. The process by which a new pope is chosen has evolved through the ages and is shrouded in centuries-old tradition and secrecy. I'm joined now by Dr. Jessica Vornberg, a historian of the religious and political history of Europe. You're very welcome to the History Show, Jessica.
Very glad to be here.
Now, before the conclave was introduced, or the idea of the conclave, in the first, 1,200 years or so of the church, what do we know about how popes were chosen?
So it's very murky and very patchy, but there are two trends amongst multiple modes of election. Some people cite up to 18, but the two trends for the way that the Holy Spirit spoke to the electors of the church were, number one, acclamation. So that was just enough people crying out the name of the right person, or the same person at least, at the same time. They could be ordinary Romans. It could happen in the procession of a pope's funeral, or they could be cardinals or the nobility. You know, it could be any number of these groups. And then the second mode was a more straightforward election, but again, involving lots of people beyond the cardinals. So it can involve the nobility, the Holy Roman Emperor, it could be supported by acclamation. So it was very changeable from election to election. But those are the two trends in that sort of motley group of election methods before the conclave.
And it could take a while because the papal election of 1268, which actually turned into the papal election of 1271, so do the maths yourself, that took place in Viterbo, in Italy, almost 3 years. Why did it take so long to select a pope, and how was an end finally put to that process?
So the reason why it took so long was because so many people were interested in who was going to become the pope. Outside political powers in this period, you know, of the 13th century, increasingly the kings of France had managed to not only get people on the papal throne who are favourable to them, but also, you know, have cardinals who are favourable to them. So you get different political factions within the conclave. That means that coming to a compromise is incredibly difficult, and the discussions get drawn out over, you know, days, weeks, months, and in this case, years. This conclave was brought to an end when several rules were put in place in order to try to speed up the election process and also inhibit outside interference. So the conclave was shut. Conclave, that term comes from the idea of being locked up with a key. They limited the amount of food that the cardinals could get in a day, the quality of the food. They were down to bread, water and wine. And what's most interesting about this election at Viterbo, I think, is that there are different theories about who enforces these rules. So some say it was actually the French king who suggested it happen because he wanted to hurry an outcome that would be favourable to him. Some people say it was the people of Viterbo and the magistrates who were sick of this conclave going on and on and on in their town. And some people say that it was actually a cardinal from the conclave electors who said, please do anything you can, take off the roof, let the Holy Ghost in, let's speed this along. So lots of people who wanted things sped up, but who probably were somewhat involved in slowing things down as well.
And I think, was it the Pope who was elected from that conclave? Was that Gregory the X?
Exactly.
Who then brings in more rules and, I suppose, to some extent anyway, creates the conclave that we know today.
Exactly. So after his election as a compromise candidate in that conclave, a few years later, he sort of solidifies those rules so that then they become, with a little bit of back and forth over the late 13th century, the rules that to a large extent, still govern the conclave, not in terms of restricting meals or, you know, giving the cardinals only bread and water, but in terms of making it very closed to speed things along and also to keep out that political interference.
So does he introduce, for example, the two-thirds majority rule and that only cardinals can select the pope?
Those rules actually came in earlier. So those are the two earlier stages for very similar reasons. So in the 11th century, the rule about cardinals being the electors came in, again, not without some changes throughout history and some, I suppose, backsliding, if you see it as a good thing. But that was to stop Holy Roman emperors and other political figures from involving themselves too much in the election process. And then in 1179, you get the two-thirds majority rule brought in by Alexander III. And again, that is to ensure that you don't get too many rival candidates. If you've got to get two-thirds, then a lot of your supporters have got to abandon you before somebody else can say, actually, I've got enough support to say I'm the Pope. The Holy Spirit was electing me. And the problem that occurred so many times over the centuries, and actually after this rule came in as well, was that you'd have rival popes, sometimes up to three, you know, dotted over Italy or, you know, at some points outside of Italy, with different groups of cardinals backed by political figures saying, no, this one's the real pope, which not only causes administrative problems in the church, but also really undermines the prestige of the papacy, which is supposed to be descended in a single line from St. Peter.
And does that include the Avignon papacy, for example?
Yeah, so Avignon continued to be a site even beyond the end of the Avignon papacy at the end of the 14th century. It continued to be a site where rival popes, anti-popes as they're called, would set up. Viterbo was another place. They popped up in Pisa as well. The popes would go there as legitimate places where they had palaces, because for quite a lot of the historical period we're talking about, popes had to leave Rome because of plague, because of war. So they had palaces in these places. But when papal elections were contested, quite often it was a rival pope who would go and set up his rival papal court at one of these other centres like Avignon, Viterbo, Perugia.
And when it comes to the papabile, or the popeable, the people who are candidates, the likely candidates for pope, has it historically always been the case that if you are a contender, this is the cliche is, go in a pope, leave a cardinal, that if you want it too much, you're not going to get it?
It's not always been the case, but there are lots of examples I can think of where actually somebody who seemed to not want it or not be the strongest candidate has emerged. So one famous example, or one that sticks in my mind anyway, from the late 16th century, is Sixtus V, who went into the conclave with, some say, white makeup on his face and crutches. And everyone thought, well, he'll be a nice seat warmer pope until we find somebody that, you know, maybe we can all agree on, or maybe this faction can agree on. And the probably apocryphal but very revealing story is that once he was elected, he chucked away the crutches and thus began five very vigorous years of action. One could say the same about John the 23rd, you know, that I think people really didn't think that he was going to reset the agenda of the church. But history unfolds in its own directions, which makes it very exciting. So quite often it is a compromise candidate who is unexpected. But even in recent years, you know, I think Benedict XVI, for example, was a pope that nobody was necessarily too shocked was elected at that time. So it can vary, but definitely the way that papal elections work and the fact that there is often split opinion means that people can emerge who maybe aren't so well known and certainly weren't contenders when they shut the Sistine Chapel doors.
And the tradition of the black smoke and the white smoke, when and how does that emerge? Because they didn't always burn the ballots, apparently.
It emerges in the 19th century. So it's a kind of classic example of one of those aspects of the papal election, which is so shrouded in secrecy for many, for everybody really sitting outside about what's going on. It becomes very characteristic of the things that we do know, but it actually comes in relatively late in the 19th century as a way of communicating with the outside world without directly communicating with the outside world.
You would imagine nowadays that cardinals would have some awareness or more awareness of each other in an era of mass communication. But I would imagine in previous centuries, and certainly going back to the Middle Ages, they would not necessarily know each other. Would they know what they were voting for, who they were voting for?
It's a really interesting question, because with this upcoming conclave, some people have been saying the opposite, that now we have so many cardinals, 135 cardinal electors, that they don't know each other, and that the church is so global now that they have far less contact than they would have in the past. I think it's always been the case, as it is now, that those who are part of the Roman Curia, so the closest to the Pope in terms of the governance of the church and previously the papal states, would have known each other. But it certainly is the case that sometimes cardinals didn't know each other. And you have stories of cardinals, sort of trying to rally against a potential candidate during a conclave, saying, I've actually gathered all of this evidence, that this candidate's a heretic. But once you're sealed in the conclave, how do you confirm that or deny that? It becomes very difficult to deal with these kind of rumours and intrigues or accusations, true or false. So I suppose that's a problem that also might persist to this day. And actually, the idea of not knowing one another might be worse now, when everything is much more dispersed from Rome, and the college has gone from, early conclaves, some of them, even in the medieval period, were around 20 cardinal electors. And now we have more than 100, more than that.
Well, the old saying goes, the church thinks in centuries. So whoever they choose will be an indication of where the Roman Catholic Church might be heading in, over the next century at least. My guest is Dr. Jessica Vorenberg. Many thanks for joining us this evening, Jessica. And Jessica is the author of the 2023 book, City of Echoes, A New History of Rome, Its Popes and Its People. After the break, we'll be hearing about the Fenian invasion of Canada in the 19th century. Stay with us. Welcome back.
What I'd like to see Canada become our 51st state. We give them protection, military protection. So I'd love to see that. But some people say that would be a long shot. If people wanted to play the game right, it would be 100% certain that they'd become a state.
Recent suggestions by Donald Trump that Canada should become the 51st state may have been provocative, but the idea is not without historical precedent. In the 19th century, some in the United States viewed British-controlled Canada not as a neighbour, but as unfinished business, a northern frontier that might yet fall under American control. In this report, Ian Kennelly explores how Irish revolutionaries, operating from US soil, sought to take advantage of that mindset by attacking Canadian territory. They envisioned a transatlantic campaign for Irish independence, one that might gain momentum through American support.
Tramp, 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 the boys are marching. Cheer up, comrades, let them come. For beneath the Union Jack, we will drive the Fenians back, and we'll fight for our beloved Canadian home.
That is Alan Mills in a song from his 1956 album, O Canada. Mills was an influential Canadian singer who popularised a wide catalogue of the country's folk songs during the 1950s and 1960s. That particular piece of music, to which he gave the simple if prosaic title of Anti-Fenian Song, references events from 1866, when the Fenian Brotherhood attacked Canadian territory. Those events, often described as the Fenian invasion of Canada, are a scarcely believable and often misunderstood story of Irish revolutionary activities. To begin that story, we hear from Dr. John Gibney, assistant editor with the Royal Irish Academy's Documents in Irish Foreign Policy programme. He describes the Brotherhood's foundation and its early development.
Much about the precise circumstances of the foundation of the Fenian movement are unclear, but we can say that on the 17th of March 1858, St. Patrick's Day, James Stephens, Thomas Clark Luby and John Denieff founded a secret conspiratorial group in Dublin that was intended to secure Irish independence through force. This obviously wasn't the first group to advocate this, but the Fenians were a far more formidable prospect. The group was known in its early years as the Irish Republican Brotherhood, sometimes the Irish Revolutionary Brotherhood, and it's worth saying that by this time, the mid-19th century, Republican had essentially come to mean a separatist in Irish political life. If Ireland was to get independence through force of arms or others, the hope was it would get it in the form of a republic of some kind. Now, alongside this organisation in Ireland, in 1859, John O'Mahony founded a sister organisation in New York, And the name of that organisation came to be used for the movement on both sides of the Atlantic, the Fenians, or the Fenian Brotherhood.
That brotherhood was formed in the aftermath of the devastation wrought by the famine and during a time of immense Irish emigration to the United States. Those emigrants arrived in the United States, it was increasingly fractious and on the verge of dissolution, a situation that led to the American Civil War, which began in 1861 and which continued for 4 years. An estimated 200,000 Irish soldiers fought in that long and brutal conflict, mostly with the Union Army. Those soldiers drew the attention of the Fenian leadership, as explained by Dr. David Doolan, author of Transnational Revolutionaries, The Fenian Invasion of Canada, 1866.
The Fenian Brotherhood thought that this was a great opportunity, that if we were going to have a revolution in Ireland, if we were going to overthrow British rule, what we needed was trained soldiers. And more to the point, actually, and this is in the records very clearly stated, they wanted military leaders. So it was the leadership that they really wanted. So we might be able to get civilians to come out and hold a gun and fight, but who's going to coordinate all of this? So the Civil War was seen as a great opportunity to do that.
During the war, the Fenians conducted recruitment campaigns, particularly in the Union Army, efforts that were, on the surface, wildly successful. At the war's end in 1865, 50,000 soldiers had committed themselves to the Brotherhood. Yet the Fenian leadership realised that only a fraction of that number was truly willing to take part in military action, perhaps less than 10,000 men. That leadership now faced the question of what to do next. Although the founding aim of the IRB had been to start an Irish rebellion, those plans were then being quashed by the British, who were carrying out mass arrests that gravely weakened the Brotherhood in Ireland. So, some Fenians began to consider a radical new strategy.
All of these things coming together refocus the energies towards what is then British North America. So not necessarily the Canada that we know today in the 20th and 21st century. It's still a British territory. It's British North America. The soldiers in Canada at the time are the Redcoats. It's the British Army. And for the Fenian Brotherhood, that's the easiest target. They're like to make some sort of a statement. Now, there's lots of ideas embedded in all of that. You have this idea that if the Fenian Brotherhood or the Irish could capture a piece of land and declare it a republic, that it would be like a springboard to actually start a revolution on the island of Ireland. For some, it's more the symbolism of it. It's like, let's strike a blow against the British Empire, and the British Empire are across the border.
The contemporary geopolitical situation, the Fenians believed, also offered a rare opportunity. There had long been a strand of thinking within the United States that advocated annexation of Canadian territory, and the mid-1860s were a time of great tension between the United States and the British Empire, a legacy of British actions during the American Civil War. For the Fenians, it meant that the US was a potential ally in a war against Britain.
There's a lot of anger in the United States towards Britain because they gave the Confederate side in the American Civil War belligerent rights, and then they also allowed the Confederate Navy to outfit their navy, their boats, in British ports. So there's all of this hostility between the US and Britain, and there's an opportunity in the minds of the Fenian Brotherhood to maybe spark an Anglo-American war. So Canada is the most obvious place.
The attitude of the US government was exemplified by its hands-off approach to the Fenians. Although technically the Fenians were an oath-bound secret organisation, there was nothing covert about their preparations to attack Canada. Not only did the US government make no effort to hinder those preparations, but the US Army also sold ammunition to the Brotherhood. That ammunition, along with weapons, the Fenians deposited in arms dumps not far from the Canadian border. Their plans, it seemed, were proceeding well, but long-standing tensions within the movement soon threatened the entire strategy.
There's a split in the Fenian Brotherhood, as all good Irish revolutionary movements. People don't see eye to eye, and there's a split. It has to do with the vision of starting a revolution on the island of Ireland by James Stephens, the leader of the IRB, who's very critical of the faction of the Fenian Brotherhood in America who start to make noises about invading Canada. So you're starting to get this split between a vision for we can strike against the British Empire on North American soil, or no, we have to wait and do it in Ireland.
On the one side of this split was John O'Mahony, leader of the Fenian Brotherhood in the United States, who was closely associated with Stevens. They were opposed by another faction led by William Roberts, a very wealthy businessman, and Thomas Sweeney, a former general in the Union Army. It was Roberts and Sweeney who won this battle of the factions, and they directed the Fenians towards an attack on Canadian territory.
The idea was that there should be a three-pronged attack across the border from the US into Canada. The preferred first prong of the attack would have been Detroit, if not Detroit, then from Chicago. The second would be from St. Albans in Vermont. And then the third front, if you like, the third crossing, was from Buffalo, New York.
The attack was scheduled to begin on the 1st of June 1866, although when the day arrived, it was immediately apparent that the Fenians' grand strategy was unravelling.
We find out that nothing's going to happen in Detroit, nothing's going to happen in Chicago. There's a delay in St. Albans, but at Buffalo, there's somewhere between 700 and 1,000 men arrive in Buffalo ready to go. To cross the Niagara River, land at a small village called Fort Erie on the Canadian side, and then begin the march inland in order to meet what the Fenians hope will be the Redcoats, the British Army.
The Fenian force that crossed from Buffalo was led by John O'Neill, an experienced soldier who had been an officer in the Union Army. After capturing Fort Erie in a brief skirmish with the Canadian militia, O'Neill marched his men inland towards a place called Ridgeway. There, they encountered a large Canadian force.
When the skirmish begins at Ridgeway, the Fenian Brotherhood, being battle-hardened soldiers, are fearless in that battle. The Canadians don't have the same experience, but they hold their own for a while. But there's a moment when, in the kind of confusion of battle, that somebody on the Canadian side shouts out, "Form square," which is a military manoeuvre to repel a cavalry. So somebody saw horses coming up from the Fenian side, and it was more than likely it was O'Neill who was on the horse, and somebody on the Canadian side panicked and thought this is a cavalry coming. So they form square, so they all take a knee, holding up their guns with the bayonets to stop the horses. But what they've done is they've become sitting ducks for the Fenian Brotherhood, and they just start picking them off. The Canadians panic, they turn and they flee. They run away. There is about 8 Fenians killed in the skirmishes, and I think close to 10 Canadians are killed in the skirmish as well.
After Ridgeway, O'Neill's scouts informed him that a large force of approximately 5,000 British troops was approaching the area, and he ordered his men back to Fort Erie, where they fought off another small group of Canadian skirmishers. O'Neill still held out hope that Fenian reinforcements would arrive, but he soon received word that none were on the way. Unwilling to risk a fight in such unfavourable circumstances, he ordered his men back to the United States. The Fenians attempted to launch a second, smaller incursion into Canadian territory that same week, but it achieved little before being broken up by US forces. By then, the federal government, perhaps unnerved by the potential for events to spiral out of control, had authorised states along the border to break up the Fenian encampments. The so-called Fenian invasion of Canada was over, although it would long be remembered by both Canadians and Irish Americans.
I think there's kind of mixed emotions about how it's remembered on both sides. I think on the Canadian side, there maybe was an element within military history that it's not a celebratory moment because of the way the actual battles of Ridgeway in particular turned out, when clearly the men ran away. But it was also kind of turned into a story. It was remembered through the lens of, you know, the stereotypes, negative stereotypes of Irish men, drunken, violent Irish men who were a little bit crazy and came across.
In the morning by my side sat the darling of my pride, and our happy children round us were at play. When the news spread through the land that the Fenians were at hand, at our country's call we'll cheerfully obey. Tramp, 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 the boys are marching. Cheer up, comrades, let them come. For beneath the Union Jack, we will drive the Fenians back, and we'll fight for our beloved Canadian home. Should this poor deluded band dare set foot upon our land or molest the rights of England's noble queen, they will meet with British pluck, English, Irish, Scotch, Canuck, and they'll wish themselves at home again, I ween.
So that legacy, I think, informed the history for a long time, not just in Canada, but I think that seeped into, it became the narrative, certainly in Irish America, certainly in upstate New York, Irish America. When I was doing my research in Buffalo over a decade ago now, talking to the Irish American community, including some politicians, Irish American politicians, the consensus was that they were told not to talk about it, that it was kind of an embarrassing part of Irish American history.
In recent years, through the work of historians such as David Doolin and local endeavours in both Buffalo and Canada, the story of the Fenian invasions has been reinvestigated and placed within its wider historical context. The Fenian raids have come to be seen as a factor in the creation of the Dominion of Canada in July 1867, a key moment in that nation's history. The events of 1866 were part of an intense period of Fenian activity in both Ireland and the United States, including further Fenian incursions into Canada during 1870 and 1871. It was a formative period in Irish revolutionary history, and we close by returning to Dr. John Gibney, who describes the legacy of those events for the Fenians, for Ireland, and for Irish Americans.
By the late 1860s, the Fenians were thinking in terms of carrying out some kind of rebellion in Ireland. They did stage a rebellion in 1867, and while that rebellion failed, the Fenians remained a potent force in Irish life throughout the late 19th century and into the 20th century. The militancy that they represented was quite popular in Irish life. The thought that they were seeking Irish independence in the face of a neglectful and repressive and rapacious British government as it was perceived. And this was a global movement. So in Ireland and also in North America, it is one of the more significant organisations in Irish life of the 19th century, because while it was a failure in terms of what it sought, it was extremely influential in terms of what it advocated.
Ian Kennelly was reporting there. He was talking to historians David Doolin and John Gibney to discuss the remarkable story behind the so-called Fenian invasion of Canada of 1866, when armed members of the Irish Republican Brotherhood crossed the border from the United States in an attempt to seize Canadian territory. After the break, Pádraig Yates joins me to talk about the Truth Recovery Process, a proposal to address the legacy of the Troubles. More than 3,500 people were killed during the Troubles. Over 45,000 were seriously injured. It was a devastating loss of life, and for many families, the pain of those years has never gone away. In the decades since the Good Friday Agreement, Northern Ireland has found peace, but not always resolution. The question of how to deal with the past remains difficult, deeply contested, and often bitter. Should victims' families still hope for justice through the courts? Or has the chance for prosecutions passed, leaving only the possibility of truth if people are willing to tell it? One group of campaigners, north and south of the border, is proposing what they call a truth recovery process, an alternative to the legal system based on voluntary disclosure, mediation and reconciliation. To talk about this, I'm joined now by historian, journalist and trade unionist Pádraig Yates. Welcome back to the programme, Pádraig.
Thanks, Mark.
If you could start by explaining what you're proposing exactly to address the legacy of the Troubles and how it differs from previous attempts at reconciliation.
Yes, certainly. It's basically a conditional amnesty proposal whereby if people are willing to come forward who have information and to give it to victims and survivors, there should be a way of doing it. There should be a forum in which this could be done, which is mediation-based rather than the adversarial, you know, arena of a courtroom. And many people, myself included, have been in courts as reporters, as you know. We've all done that as journalists, but also as a witness, as a plaintiff, as a defendant. And the one thing I have never witnessed, ever,
is reconciliation.
No, I never felt I was in the process of that. So what we're proposing is you have to, if you like, you have to disarm the various sides. You have to get them into a room to agree terms of engagement and look for the truth. And the deal, the quid pro quo is that if people are willing to come forward and give information, there should be some way in which they can do so and give it if they desire it, directly to families of the victims or to the victims themselves where they have survived. I'm not saying that is easy, but we think it's the only way of establishing the facts. Because fundamentally, if we cannot get reconciliation on the facts of what happened, getting reconciliation on anything else is very difficult and often very superficial.
So it's not like the South African Truth and Reconciliation process, which was very public. It's a kind of an ex-cathedra process. It's happening outside of the public gaze.
It is, but we do recommend that where people go through the process and they feel it was worthwhile doing and they're willing to do this, they should become advocates for the process, because we do think it can yield better results for society and for the individuals concerned than anything that will happen in a courtroom.
And this would include members of the security forces as well as paramilitaries?
Yes.
So that's kind of complicated by a certain piece of legislation that we'll perhaps talk about in a while. But it's not an adversarial process. It doesn't involve the courts, but it might involve judges, I think, would it?
Well, we accept there would have to be judicial oversight in some form or other. And like the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, you know, we could have a situation where external judges, they could be appointed by the Irish and British governments. They could be appointed through some other body if they so wish, like the European Court, but there would be oversight. But the idea is that you wouldn't need to go to judges to get a judgment, to get at someone saying this is right and this is wrong. We would hope to overcome that. And there have been a few cases, individual cases, where people on their own initiative have done something similar. The only one I'm really aware of is the John Crawford case, who was a Catholic businessman, small businessman, in West Belfast, who was killed. It took some time to find out who did it. It turned out to be the UVF. And Winston Irvine, who's been in the news recently for other reasons, but he was a leading figure in the organisation, and he facilitated a truth recovery process. And both sides agreed. John Crawford on the family side and the UVF agreed on an approach that they were going to find out what happened and why it happened. They were not going to go into who did it and pursue justice in that form. He was willing to accept that system, and it's very close to what we're proposing. So that's the only example I can think of where people did that. But the trouble is, in the north, you have this huge machinery now, judicial machinery, and something like a third of all the lawyers in Northern Ireland are dependent to a greater or lesser extent on the courts for an income. So there's a huge lobby there for perpetuating the system. And what people instinctively do now, or you know, naturally do because of all the publicity, if they think they have a case involving themselves or a relative, they go and see a lawyer and it goes straight into the legal process. But very, very few of these cases are going to be resolved. There's at least a thousand outstanding legacy cases. There's also the problem, and I'm aware of it, anyone who's had any involvement in this sort of thing is aware of it, where people have gone to prison, quite a number of people have gone to prison for things they didn't do because of the nature of a conflict. And what happens there is, particularly in the early years of the conflict, where an organisation would claim a killing, but say we killed so-and-so, they might even say it was C company of whatever organisation it was, loyalist or Republican. So immediately that narrows the circle of suspects. The police and the army go around rounding up people, bring them in. They get a confession out of somebody, or they get enough information or evidence to charge them. And that person really, the only defence they have is really to turn informer. Because if they don't, they can't just say, well,
they have to be able to finger who actually did it.
To get out of it themselves, yeah. That dilemma, they have to say, it wasn't me, it was him.
And the rationale on the part of the security forces is, okay, we're banging this person up for something they didn't do, but they probably did something anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. And which is possibly true too, but yes, you know, it's the nature of the conflict. The conflict was a communal conflict. It wasn't a discrete crime. It wasn't a man murdering his wife or someone robbing a bank and shooting the teller in the process. This was planned, premeditated usually, and there were quite a number of people involved. But the people who end up in the dock, and the same applies with security forces, is usually the person who pulls the trigger or who plants the bomb. It's not the person who ordered it. And that is the big, we think, injustice in the whole system.
Because there's a conspiracy involved, and conspiracy is a crime.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Are you talking?
But it's a very hard crime to prove.
Well, it's a very, indeed, it is very, very hard to prove. You're talking about if people do come forward and they have information and they volunteer that information, would they be subject to an amnesty, or would it just be the case that whatever testimony they give in whatever forum they give that testimony could not be used against them? They couldn't incriminate themselves.
Well, yes, there's a process which is long established called protected disclosure. Mm. So if you come forward under protected disclosure process, that information you give cannot be used against you.
So it's whistleblower legislation.
In that sense, it is. But in fact, that it has been very successful in retrieving the bodies of the missing, the disappeared. Most of them have been retrieved through that process because people came forward. And interestingly enough, nobody so far has been charged, let alone convicted, on the basis of information that came through protected disclosure. So the system does work. And what we're trying to do is bridge the gap between protected disclosure and some form of amnesty that would be, you know, compliant with European law, but would also give people the space to engage with each other as well as with the courts, instead of the courts or instead of the, if you like, the institutions of the state.
Now, there's a piece of legislation which might interfere with the process that you're talking about, and that's the short term for it is the Legacy Act. It's the Northern Ireland Troubles Legacy and Reconciliation Act, to give it its full title, introduced by the Tory government, now being amended by the Labour government. Explain how it was supposed to work and how it differs from your proposals and how it might interfere with, perhaps, with your proposals.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm subject to correction on this, but my understanding of it is that it was aimed primarily at dealing with the security forces problem. So where soldiers come forward and give evidence, again, truthfully, they will then be dealt with more leniently than would be the case if they were simply arrested and charged on suspicion and had to go through the whole gamut of the legal process. But there's a number of problems with it. The most important one, I suppose, is simply that there's no faith in it. There's no confidence that it will work because people in the North assume the system is loaded in favour of the soldiers. And also the very idea, well, if you own up and say, yes, I killed somebody, it offends against people's sense of justice. Because you've owned up to it, you can walk away. And the problem is that, unfortunately, given the antagonism in the North, given the depth of feeling in the North, it's an incendiary way of trying to deal with the problem, which was devised by people who probably are not that aware or sensitive to the issues involved. I mean, we did meet with the Northern Ireland office on a number of occasions, and in fact, they filched, if you like, some of our ideas from us, which they then regurgitated in this act. But they're fundamentally different because we take it out of the legal forum. But it is based on people opting into it. That is the first hurdle, if you like, has to be overcome. If people come forward and say, yes, I have information on the deaths of so-and-so, or a bombing that caused a lot of injury, the families, at least one member of the family has to say, yes, I am willing to go down this route.
And what has been the reception for your ideas in London, Dublin and Belfast on an official level, a governmental level?
None, really, basically, to be honest. We've had good engagement with the Northern Ireland office, but I suppose they have more skin in the game than anybody else. But we have met with them, been very impressed by them. They've asked us a lot of questions, and they've incorporated some of our ideas into their legislation. We've had very little engagement in the South. I think the Dublin government and the Department of Foreign Affairs think, well, it's really a problem for the Brits. And they've, up until now, until the OMA inquiry, I suppose, they've kept a good distance from it, and they're still pursuing this member state case against the British government, which creates sort of clear water between them and the Brits about what's going on up there, and we're really nothing to do with it.
This is the legacy. I mean, they're basically challenging
the Legacy Act,
Which I suppose in a way puts them in an invidious position as far as your approach is concerned. Has there been a paramilitary response? Have you approached former paramilitaries?
Yeah. When we did set it up, we're a very small group, but we approached various people. We had six people who agreed to participate in this process, if it was established by the two governments, and they would take part. And a couple of them had a lot of information. That was in the winter of 2018, 2019, when we first kicked this idea around. So we set up our small group. It's a company limited by guarantee. We've no funding from anybody apart from ourselves. Unfortunately, since then, two of them have died of cancer. One has died of COVID and one has dementia. We haven't gone looking for more people. There's no point, because unless there is a process, a willingness to engage, you know, and the reality is, I think the reality is that the permanent government, North and South, and a lot of the politicians take the easy option, which is just string it out until everyone's dead, and then we can forget about it.
And there is a time element here, because one of the interesting things is that I think more than half of the casualties, or fatalities anyway, are pre-1976.
That's
so
right.
So we're talking about, about more than almost 50 years.
Sure, the worst years, the early 70s. It was a period of internment, basically, and there was no real law in the normal sense, but simply by having internment, you had military dictatorship, in a sense. Anyone could be lifted off the streets, and worse. I mean, there's some peculiar things have emerged. I'll give you an example. I know two people, and there's far more of them, but I know two people who were both contacted by large legal practices and told, you are entitled to compensation for your time, for some of your time in prison. And they were mystified, because they sort of was open and shut, really, cases. And they explained to this lad who was done for conviction for possession of a terrorist weapon, for example, that when he was arrested, he was 17 and he was detained in the Mays prison. And then he was convicted and then he served the sentence. But the period from his arrest up until his 18th birthday, he was illegally detained and therefore he was entitled to compensation.
So, well, obviously a lot of legal firms are doing quite a lot of research. I mean, you know, we would call this in other contexts ambulance chasing, would we?
Well, you might, yes. I mean, this is a problem. When people get a mindset, this is the way to go, this is how things should be done, then other people pile in and say, yes, well, we can fine-tune it in this way or improve it in that way. So, yes, that is the problem. Now, I don't emphasise that too much because, A, I don't annoy the legal profession too much, but B, we need an alternative to the courts. You cannot, after any large-scale conflict, as you know yourself as a historian, that at some point the curtain has to be pulled down.
Yeah, I mean, 1921, the curtain, or 22, the curtain was pulled down. 1924, after the Civil War, the same thing, the curtain was pulled down.
Yes, otherwise we couldn't have had the degree of reconciliation such as it was that happened after that.
If we can talk a little bit about a couple of your own experiences and apply them to this situation. I mean, in a truth recovery process, it's a process that you yourself could take part in, because you, 1,000 years ago, were a member of the IRA.
That's my excuse. I joined the movement when I was 17. I was recruited to the IRA when I was 18. When the split came in 69-70, I stayed with what became known as the officials. Most people I think I knew or was aware of stayed with the official movement. And really, the Provosts were born out of Belfast and out of the pogroms in 69. That's where their origins lie. And they grew from there, and they had a very, initially very simplistic approach. They've developed it since, I first to acknowledge that. And we didn't get anywhere because we basically tried to apply class politics, you know, the old Wolf Tone unity of Catholic, Protestant and dissenter, to look for equal economic and social justice.
And you were on ceasefire from 1972.
There was a brief interval with that in 74. But apart from that, yes. But the other interesting thing I did notice when I started doing this, one of the reasons I started doing it, is that I realised I knew 31 people whose names I could recollect who were killed violently in the Troubles. And I was amazed. Only two of them were killed by loyalists, I think, or two or three were killed by loyalists, sorry, three. Five were killed by the British Army, and all the others were Republicans killed by other Republicans in the feuds. A lot of people died after the bloodiest period. I mean, for the internal feuds amongst Republicans, you know, 75 was a bad year. 76 was a bad year. I think the last serious one was around 78. And some people who were dead almost certainly died in internal rows. that nobody knows the details of who wasn't involved.
And in your specific case, though, to some extent, your very, very early involvement as a very, very young man comes back in 2019 in the Ballymurphy 10 inquest. You were asked to give evidence. You didn't have to, but you did.
Well, I was summoned. I mean, I don't think they're going to extradite me if I didn't turn up. But I was summoned then out of courtesy to the court. And I did explain to the judge's, the coroner's office, that I felt I had very little to contribute because it was 50 years ago. And I didn't know Belfast well at the time. In fact, Ballymurphy was in darkness for a lot of the time because there was no public lighting. It had all been wrecked in previous riots. But I gave my evidence to the best of my ability. And I found myself being sort of threatened with contempt because some of the information I gave was given to me by someone I'd met subsequently who was a loyalist. And one of the reasons I went and gave evidence is because a number of other people said, well, look, if you give evidence and it works, and we might give evidence. So when I went into the court, I knew there were other people in the courtroom or people on the grapevine who would hear afterwards what had happened, who would be interested to see what happened to me. So when I was confronted basically by one of the lawyers for two of the families, I was persistently asked to name my source, who this person was. And of course, I had to refuse and explain to the judge I'd given my word. But eventually, the judge obviously didn't want to lock me up and derail, you know, an important process over this fairly minor row, really, as I saw it. And I think she saw it. So I said to her, look, if she gave me, you know, the capacity, the facility to do it, I would go and I would try and persuade the person concerned to come forward and give evidence themselves rather than rely on what I had to say. And she accepted that. And I did make an attempt, not very successful. I think I knew that and the judge knew that, but I did that. But it just underlined the whole point that
lawyers didn't encourage the others to come forward.
In fact, one of them actually came back to me afterwards and said, look, he said, appreciate what you were trying to do there. He said, but it's not going to work. So they didn't give evidence. I don't know how good or bad that evidence would have been. So we'll just never know. But that is the problem people face. You go into court and you... You go into court, you give an affidavit, you are nailed to that affidavit. You stray from it by one word or one sentence. And they say, well, hold on, you said on the oath here, you know, are you now saying, are you a liar? Are you making this up? You know, so it's such a bizarre, I mean, this is a system devised back in the Middle Ages to end blood feuds. And we're still using the same process 1,000-odd years later. And I just think it's madness when you're dealing with a very complex social problem. It's not just individual crimes by individual people. It's society at war with itself. And I don't know about you, but I never realized that fear was such an infectious, you know, emotion until you're there. And suddenly, people say, they're coming. And you don't have to say, well, who are they? Or what are they coming for? People just know they're coming. And this is a problem and someone has to deal with it. And people would cry out for defense by somebody. And it doesn't matter who it is, they need someone to stand up for them at that moment in time. A week later, they may regret it deeply and say, I wish I'd never spoken to those people. I wish I didn't know them. But that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, the truth recovery process is one proposal to deal with the legacy of the Troubles, whether that's possible or welcome is for victims, survivors, and I suppose for society to decide. You can read more about these arguments and coverage of this debate over truth and reconciliation on the website truthrecoveryprocess.ie. My guest is Pádraig Gates. Pádraig, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Miles.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer, Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.